And now that plastic pollution is ubiquitous, the science is showing that as we've been sitting here, you and I are breathing tiny plastic particles. There's plastic fallout. It falls as an invisible rain all over the planet.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Allison Cobb, a poet and writer who works for the Environmental Defense Fund. Her latest book is Plastic and Autobiography, a book of fragmented and interconnected stories about plastic's history, its place in our consumerist culture, and its impact on the environment. Her work has appeared in Best American Poetry, Denver Quarterly, and many other journals. Allison lives in Portland, Oregon. Allison, welcome to The Right Question.
Well, thank you, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
You know what? Let's just start off with a reading, if you don't mind. Would you mind reading something from Plastic in Autobiography?
I'd be happy to do that. So the book opens with an epigraph by the writer Rebecca Solnit that goes, "I wanted to trace the lost patterns that came before the world was broken and find the new ones we could make out of the shards." The thing turned up in a corner of the yard, just outside the fence. I found it when I went out to take Quincy for a walk. Curved and black, plastic, 4 feet long, a foot at its widest. I thought at first it was a car bumper. I put it in the grass by the porch. The next morning it was still there. I sat next to it in the sun and looked closely. It was not the first piece of plastic junk I had sat staring at. For nearly a year, I'd been picking up all the plastic I found on my daily dog walk. I'd been arranging it into patterns, taking photographs. I'd been storing it all up in plastic garbage bags on the back porch. I didn't know exactly why I was doing this. I wanted to understand something. Plastic on the dog walk, plastic on visits to the beach, plastic studding the ground everywhere I looked. I gathered it all up. I am the no and the yes. A line from the poet Hannah Sobelman's first book. It has lived with me for years, sometimes whispering through my mind in its old remembered rhythm. In the poem, Sobelman follows the line with a qualifying phrase. She narrows it, makes it domestic, but I want the raw declaration hanging there on the turn of itself. I am the no and the yes. For nearly half my life, I have worked for an environmental group. I spend most of my days in front of a computer screen, taking in a deluge of information about planetary trauma and emergency. Most of it floods through me, too vast to grasp. But plastic was a shard that stuck. Plastic I could touch, and it could touch me back. I dragged the car part inside the house. Nearly 10 years later, it sits beside me, near my desk. I learned this, that the world is not broken, or that it has always been shards, kaleidoscopically interwoven, not one world, many, threaded through one another, like fungus hyphae through soil. Worlds end. As Catherine Yusoff points out, in a billion black Anthropocenes or none, some worlds have ended over and over, lives consumed and discarded by individuals woven into systems that give them life and death power, like settler colonialism, like capitalism. These are systems built by humans, but they exceed individuals. They extend across generations and geographies, planet-scale forces of destruction. Plastic waste stems from this consume and dispose violence. I learned that waste is not an unintended consequence of a miracle new technology. Waste is inherent in plastic production as it accelerated after World War II. In 1945, days before the U.S. military incinerated two cities with atomic bombs, a DuPont executive looked forward to the end of the war and the surge of buying that would follow as soldiers returned home and bought houses and cars, washing machines and refrigerators. The job ahead, he told a group of marketing experts, see to it that Americans are never satisfied. Plastic embodies this infinite desire. Conjured out of gas and oil, the seemingly endless reservoirs of dead plants and animals underlying Earth, plastic transmutes death into eternal life. The word plastic refers not to any specific object, just the quality of a material, that it is capable of taking shape, an endless stream of new shapes.
The title of this book is Plastic, an Autobiography, but this book is much more than your own history, your family's history. So I want to know, why did you land on the title, an autobiography?
As I write in the book, the title Plastic and Autobiography came to me at some point sort of out of the blue. And most of the journey of the book was actually figuring out what the heck I meant by that, what that might possibly mean. And what I came to learn in writing the book is that we are so interconnected with all things on the planet now because our technology is global and the benefits and the devastation of our technology is global. We can't ignore our interconnections. I think that the pandemic has really taught us that in such a stark way, though not all are wanting that lesson. And so for me, the title Plastic and Autobiography is a means of really stretching the idea of what it means to be an individual self. That autobiography encompasses the past, other people, people I know and don't know, the future, and inanimate objects like this plastic car part. My publisher, on reading the book, was, as we were preparing it for publication, was a little taken aback because originally the book did not start with me at all. It started with the scientist who developed the thermonuclear bomb, and I didn't even appear in the book until some maybe 30 pages in. And my editor and publisher had a little talk with me and said, well, if we're calling this book an autobiography, I think we need to give your readers something of you a little bit closer to the front of the book. So that's how the sort of preface of the book got written, as a way to help bring the reader into the stories and not have such a jarring departure from autobiography. So I've moderated my journey a little bit. And also my instinct is really not to write much about myself personally. That's a little bit of a stretch for me and a little uncomfortable, although there is a lot of me in the book. And I really did, my project really was that I wanted to link plastic as a technology to my own life in as many threads and ways as I could in order to make this sort of nameless, faceless technological object more human. And so I did want to create those links to myself. And also I wanted to stretch the concept of what an autobiography could be.
Women played a once invisible, and I say once invisible just because your book sort of brings their roles and their history to life, but women played a once invisible role in nuclear technology and in computer science and programming. They were once called data analysts. Instead of collaborators, they were called pupils, or they were erased from those histories altogether. But they're not the only people erased from these histories either, right? Indigenous populations are often absent from the stories and the histories of this country and of the world. And the non-human, too, is an integral part of this book. And I'd love to give some space to them here. And do you feel that the book is balanced in this way? The stories you tell, whose stories you tell, and the stories you don't? And how were you able to find that balance?
I doubt that the book is balanced. I think that recovering 400 years of erased history in this country and longer histories of erasure elsewhere around the world is a very difficult task. Again, one it will take all of us working on to do. So I would not claim that the book is balanced. I have a moment in the book of recognition where I suddenly see that I have erased most of the women from the story because I had been unconsciously replicating the patriarchal histories of technology that I had been reading. And that sends me on a really different trajectory of very consciously working to recover those histories. For example, the physicist Lisa Meitner, who was the first to discover fission, a Jewish physicist who was in exile from Nazi Germany at the time and whose contributions have been largely erased, although recovered in recent years. So that was a conscious effort in the book. And another conscious effort really in the last third of the book was to turn toward the Black women and women activists in the Gulf South of the United States, where most plastic plants are located, and also in the Pacific Islands, where women are leading the struggle against plastic waste and climate change, and to just follow their expertise and their wisdom and bear witness to it and learn from it. And also some indigenous scholars as well, or who are the ones who taught me about the power of joy and desire. I had been thinking during a lot of the writing of this book of desire as a damaging trait, as the thing that global capitalism fuels and exploits in its drive to sell us ever more products. And I came to learn from both Robin Wall Kimmerer, the indigenous writer and scientist I mentioned earlier, and another indigenous scholar named Eve Tuck, that desire can also be a powerful positive influence as a way of doing the reimagining of the world. And it is those people whose worlds are literally have been destroyed or face destruction that are most acutely feeling the need for a reimagined reality. And their health and survival and well-being depends on those of us who are more privileged and more protected joining them in that act of imagination. So for me, the journey of the book is really toward that future orientation, that positive desire and imagination that's located in these women of color and indigenous leaders who taught me so much.
There is so much to this book, right? But I do want to give you the space to talk about anything you'd like listeners to know about the book, whether that be a thread in the book or a story, a certain idea. I do want to give you that space to talk about it. So is there anything that you'd like to talk about in that respect?
Sure, I'd be happy to. There were many surprises and discoveries in the book, and one of them was I knew that I wanted to write about not just plastic waste at the end of its life when it ends up in the ocean and we see those terrible pictures of plastic straws and a sea turtle's nose and that kind of thing, but also about the less visible part of plastic, which is when plastic is produced and people who live near those plastic plants and suffer from that pollution. And so in 2014, I visited a town called Freeport, Texas, which is right on the Gulf of Mexico. And people may know that most of the nation's petrochemical infrastructure exists on the Gulf Coast. Texas and Louisiana is where most plastic and oil and gas are produced. I visited this community and spoke with some activist leaders there, a woman named Melanie Oldham. And when I left, just as I left, she texted me and said that Dow Chemical, which is in the town and has one of the largest plastic plants on the planet, had just filed for a permit to expand its plant. And what was happening was that was the first signal of what has become a $200 billion build out of plastic plants on the Gulf Coast. The plastic industry is expanding, and they are building new plants because there's so much cheap gas from fracking, and the industry has seen the end of demand for gas and oil in cars. But the projections show that plastic demand around the world is only expected to rise. And so they're putting their bets on plastic as their future profit maker very deliberately. And I want people to know that because I don't know how widely understood that is, that these communities already feeling a huge amount of pollution from plastic and chemical plants are only having to bear more as new plants are built. And I also want people to know that plastic waste is not an accident of this great new technology, that waste was actually part of the design of the industry. In the 1950s, after World War II, when plastic was taking off, the industry looked around and said, oh, this lasts forever. And people who lived through World War II and the Depression are saving their plastic tumblers and their plastic spoons because they're so durable. So we have to convince people to throw these things out so that we can make more. They said, there was one executive who said the future of plastics is in the trash can. And the industry's great innovation was the single-use plastic item. So that was by design. It was not an accident. And now that plastic pollution is ubiquitous, the science is showing that as we've been sitting here, you and I are breathing tiny plastic particles. When we eat and drink, we're taking in tiny plastic particles. There's plastic fallout. It falls as an invisible rain all over the planet. It's literally everywhere. Now we have this crisis of plastic pollution, and industry is very nervous that people become aware of and active about that because it will mean they have to change the whole paradigm of an industry whose profit is based on waste.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Allison Cobb, author of Plastic and Autobiography. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. As someone who has worked for the Environmental Defense Fund, finding this car part couldn't have been the first time that plastic entered your sphere. And not too far into plastic, this book, your then companion Jen makes a comment that this car part might be your so-called white whale. So starting from the beginning, when did plastic become an obsession? Collecting it, cataloging it, and then obviously writing about it. You said that this book has been a decade in the making.
That's true. Although plastic had been sort of rattling around in my mind metaphorically for longer than that, I was still living in New York City when I came across an article in the Los Angeles Times. It was 2006, about an albatross chick that had died from consuming so much plastic. You may have seen, or some of your listeners may have seen, these photos of albatross chicks that have been fed pieces of plastic by their parents from the ocean because there's food attached, flying fish eggs and other bits of food, and they haven't evolved to encounter plastic. And so the chicks ingest all this plastic, and then they can't eat anymore, and they can't get the plastic out, and they die. And a photographer named Chris Jordan has taken gorgeous and troubling photos of decayed albatross carcasses surrounding these cores of plastic that, of course, haven't broken down. So there was an article about this phenomenon, and one of the pieces of plastic from inside that albatross had been dated back to World War II. And that fact just kind of stuck in my mind for many years. And it wasn't until about 2011, so 5 years later, that I started actually in earnest writing the book. But that was one fact that I went back to that really propelled the writing forward.
about this photograph, you write in the book that it stayed in your brain. It became a shard that stuck. And I think that was a phrase that you read in the introduction too. Now that plastic is alive in the world, it's been published, what is another shard, a current shard that is stuck? What are you obsessing over now? Or maybe a better question in line with the book, what do you desire now?
Oh, that's such a wonderful question. I came to learn in writing this book. I met in the writing of the book with many communities who are living on the front lines of our crises, communities living in the shadow of plastic plants and their pollution, and also communities facing in the Pacific Islands, in the Marshall Islands, facing not only plastic waste, but also rising seas from climate change and nuclear contamination. And what I learned from them is that joy and, as you say it so well, desire are powerful, resilient, animating forces. As an environmentalist and person who's worked in the environmental field for 20 years, I sometimes get overwhelmed and feel some despair about the state of our planet. And I really learned in writing this book that joy is wiser and more powerful place to start from. And so I am a poet by training. And so I've returned to poetry and have been sort of meditating on grief. This is, of course, a time of such grief in our world, and joy as being sort of sides of the same coin or connected on a spectrum, and just exploring dwelling in those states as a way of figuring out how we can live now on the planet.
I'm a big fan of your poetry, specifically After We All Died. And so this question sort of stems from that. But I think that it also has to do with your previous book, Greenwood, too. The word loss, which you mention in plastic, has an Old English origin. It's the total dissolution, to break apart. This book is, you know, maybe not at its heart, but certainly, you know, it's orbiting this idea of a dying planet. Greenwood, like I said, it is about these cemeteries. The cemetery, After We All Died, is about extinction and living on, again, this dying planet. I'm wondering, how have your considerations on or of death specifically changed the way you live, that you go about your days?
When I was writing my book, Greenwood, which, as you note, is about a cemetery, my mother used to ask me why I spent so much time in a cemetery. She was a little worried about me. And what she didn't understand about the cemetery is that as one of the largest open spaces in Brooklyn, New York, more than half the size of Central Park, the Greenwood Cemetery was this incredible space of life in the middle of the city, full of birds and snapping turtles and the ponds and frogs. And I was constantly going around a bend and being delighted by some living thing. I have had the same kind of experience in the wake of my mother's death. So during the writing of this book on plastic, my mother died, and she died very quickly. She had lung cancer and was sick for about 3 weeks before she died, after her diagnosis. And I was able to be with her the entire time. And it was such a transforming and, of course, grief-filled experience. But it has really fueled my current thinking also around these links between joy and grief and how deeply linked they are. And in some ways, the ability to feel one depends on the ability to feel the other. Because as humans and feeling beings, we don't only get to feel one end of the spectrum. That's kind of the deal we are assigned. After my mother died, I really changed my views of death because, and I write this in the book, I always felt, had a very secular kind of belief in death that, you know, that's it. You go to the dirt and that's the end of your life. And very much to my surprise, I had real, tangible, concrete experiences after my mother died of her presence. And I'd heard these stories and always, including from people in my own family, and always sort of dismissed them as, you know, comforting fictions for people who are grieving. until I had my own very real and specific experiences of my mother, the individual that she was as a presence with me after her death. And that just opened my entire universe of possibilities for what even life and death might mean and how they're connected. And in fact, in the months after my mother died, I felt more connected to her in some ways than when she'd been alive. And I kind of walked around in this sort of fog of, it was joy a little bit. It was an altered state, but it was a little bit of joy at this connection I felt and this discovery. There's a lot to be sad about in our world, and there's so much loss. You mentioned me writing about loss in this plastic book and the previous book, After We All Died, extinction of so many species, a world that we can't even imagine, a natural world populated with so many beings that, you know, you and I can't even imagine because it's irrevocably gone. There's much to mourn. And also, that's not a stopping place. There's also so much possibility. And I think of the words of the Indigenous writer, Robin Wall Kimmerer, who I write about in the book. You know, she says that the world gives her joy every day, an experience of joy, and it's her job to return the gift and continue the gift. And I take that now as almost a responsibility or a charge to, while I have this life in this form on this earth, to participate in that joy as a way of also giving it to others.
So in a section titled Work, you write, "This is the job I do, to make others feel sorrow and concern, but not despair, to give them hope, which means to desire and expect, to look forward with surety that the thing they want will come to pass." So I'm wondering, after readers have read Plastic and Autobiography, what would readers do? How might they take action? What do they feel after reading Plastic?
I don't want readers to feel despair. I want them to feel the hope and possibility that the book suggests. I do want readers to join me in, and I think many readers and your listeners are already here feeling a sense of real concern and sadness about the state of our planet and the state of our society. And I want readers to consider embarking on a real act of radical imagination for thinking through a new way of living on the planet, because as the writer Naomi Klein titled her climate change book, "This Changes Everything," we really have to change the basic structures in our economic system if we're going to find a sustainable way of living on the planet. And it's going to take a big act of imagination, also technology, also laws, also regulations, all of those things. But fundamentally, I think a tremendous act of imagination on behalf of many of us to bring to reality a new way of living on the planet. And I just hope that this book offers a small suggestion or hint of that possibility.
Allison, thank you so much for joining me.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Look for more information about Allison at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.